This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Tax breaks, jobs, worker productivity, Libya, Apple, and climate change. We'll put it all together for you from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Allianz, providing investment, insurance, and retirement solutions through its affiliated companies in the U.S. since 1896. AllianzUSA.com. And by the Batten Institute at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, presenting the Jefferson Innovation Summit, a conversation about creating and sustaining an entrepreneurial future.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Thursday. It's the 1st of September today, and one hates to begin with a report from an organization with the somewhat opaque name of the Institute for Supply Management. But the ISM is kind of where it's at today, economically speaking. They put out a survey every month of the supply chain, factory orders, production capacity, that kind of thing. Today's number was weak, weaker than many would have liked, and not a promising sign for those hoping to see signs of economic life tomorrow when the August unemployment report comes out. On the topic of jobs, by the way, we turn our attention now to Amazon. The online retailer of just about everything is promising to bring thousands of jobs to California if only the state will give it a tax break. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins has the details.
Analyst Roger Kay says this carrot-and-stick approach to jobs is a reflection of hard times.
The strong during the recessionary period have gotten stronger, and they're using that advantage in basically every domain.
Amazon has been fighting over sales tax in several states. Traditionally, internet retailers haven't paid it. But California this year passed a law requiring all internet retailers to collect and pay. Amazon shot back with, what else, a ballot measure. Let the voters decide if they want sales tax. California lawmakers are now trying to pass a bill that would basically make the original law exempt from a challenge by referendum. And then along comes Amazon's promise.
Anytime you can go into a legislature and say we're going to create jobs, it makes you look popular.
Bill Dombrowski is the president of the California Retailers Association. Amazon has offered to build 2 distribution centers and bring 7,000 jobs to the state. Roger Kay says, don't blink, California.
California needs the money, but my sense is that California shouldn't respond to that sort of blackmail.
The state estimates sales tax would bring in around $83 million a year from Amazon alone, $317 million from all internet retailers. Income tax from Amazon's promised 7,000 jobs might add up to 2.5% of that. Amazon declined to comment for this story, but Lenny Goldberg of the California Tax Reform Association is not impressed.
I think it's pretty cynical. It basically says, let's improve our market position in California. Oh, and meanwhile, let's avoid sales tax.
He says the only possible upside from those new distribution centers, maybe cheaper shipping. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
We learned this morning worker productivity is down. The number of widgets we produced per hour had its biggest drop since 2008. Kind of an interesting number, actually, because for a good long while, companies haven't had to hire because workers have been so productive, able to do as much or more with less. So are the labor times a-changing? From Washington Marketplace's David Gura reports.
Here's how the Labor Department defines productivity. It's how much output, how much of something you're able to make for every hour of work. Josh Shapiro is chief U.S. economist at MFR, an economic consulting firm. Last quarter, output was up, but not by very much, just over 1%.
With output growth very sluggish, companies have really cut their labor force and hours worked, and it's very hard to squeeze any additional productivity gains out of the labor force at this stage.
Shapiro says businesses have been trying to do all they can with what they've got.
companies haven't hired people because they haven't needed to. They've been able to produce what was necessary with their existing labor force.
So maybe the labor force has been maxed out. I asked Josh Shapiro if that could encourage companies to hire.
I don't think that running out and hiring people in a period where demand is weakening is a very likely scenario.
If anything, some companies may have too many workers. Lawrence Michel heads the Economic Policy Institute.
We've had much slower growth than employers thought there would be, and therefore employment was higher than needed to produce what they could sell.
With all this bad news, slow growth, sluggish demand, executives have a lot to think about besides hiring. Pat Newport is with IHS Global Insight.
So companies be more careful about how they spend their money.
They're focusing on how to cut costs. And even when companies do start to hire, they'll have to spend time and money on something that's not going to boost productivity, training those new employees. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
In New York today, there was a trip back to the mortgage mess of yesteryear. State regulators announced a settlement with Goldman Sachs for some of the sketchy practices that contributed to the housing crisis. Stuff like shoddy paperwork and foreclosure robo-signing by the tens of thousands. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports the settlement amount is relatively small. Its implications, though, are anything but.
Goldman Sachs and two other firms agreed to stop robo-signing, which they were already supposed to have done anyway. Goldman also agreed to lop 25% off the home loan amounts of some New Yorkers who are delinquent on their mortgage payments. That will cost Goldman about $50 million. Sounds like small potatoes, but it's actually what makes the settlement so significant, says Georgetown law professor Adam Levitin.
It's setting a precedent for principal reduction. That's the really important thing about this settlement.
Levitin says banks have been willing to help struggling homeowners by cutting the interest rates on their loans, but have resisted reducing the principal amount owed. This case could break that resistance. John Coffey directs the Center on Corporate Governance at Columbia University.
Oh, I think it will be a template. Much of the rest of the industry is looking for some kind of form settlement that they can agree to.
More states are pursuing their own cases against mortgage companies. Harvard housing economist Nicholas Ritsinas says the banks would prefer one big settlement, including state and federal regulators. But that might not happen, since federal regulators don't want to impose fines big enough to cause another banking crisis. And he says settling state by state isn't great for the housing market either.
What this market most suffers from now is uncertainty, that it never seems to end. The problems continue to kind of dribble out.
Federal regulators are taking some action. Today, the Federal Reserve also ordered Goldman to review its loan servicing practices, adding it to 14 other big banks that are likely to face fines. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders had a case of the ISM blues. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There was a big meeting in Paris today, 42 years to the day after Muammar Gaddafi took power. Leaders of the National Transitional Council met with leaders of more than 60 other countries to talk political and economic reconstruction. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was there. She said the rebels still face serious challenges in rebuilding their country. Commentator Reza Aslan says money's not one of them.
The National Transitional Council, or NTC, will have to rebuild Libya's crumbling infrastructure practically from the ground up. And that's going to cost money. A lot of money. The good news is money is one thing that Libya doesn't lack. Libya is the world's 18th largest supplier of oil. Yes, oil exports have dropped from a high of 1.6 million barrels a day before the uprising to less than 100,000 barrels today. But experts say it will take less than a year to get oil production back to pre-war levels. Already, a slew of oil company executives are en route to Libya. Libya also has about $10 billion in gold reserves at its disposal. And as we all know, the price of gold keeps rising and rising. Add to all this the $100 billion in frozen assets owed to it by foreign governments, and it's clear that lack of money is not going to be a problem for the new Libyan government. The problem will be how to use the money it has to heal the deep tribal divisions between wealthy Tripoli and impoverished Benghazi. For 40 years, Gaddafi exploited this divide to his own advantage. He placed all government institutions in Tripoli and showered it with riches. But he brutally oppressed the people of Benghazi, and allowed the city to fall to ruin. There are those in Tripoli who are convinced that the Benghazi-based NTC plans to make up for decades of neglect by shutting Tripoli out of the post-revolutionary spending spree. This would be a terrible mistake. As we learned in Iraq, the desire for an oppressed community to avenge itself can be a recipe for years of bloodshed and civil chaos. Such instability would frighten off both foreign investors and humanitarian aid groups. That is the one thing a wealthy country like Libya can't afford. If the NTC cannot heal the rift between Tripoli and Benghazi, then no amount of money will bring peace and stability to the country.
Reza Aslan's most recent book is called There Is No God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam. Share your thoughts with us. Write to us at marketplace.org. All you have to do is click on that link that says contact. Coming up, rising sea levels, bigger storms, and what cities ought to be doing about it.
Climate adaptation is looking out 25, 50 years into the future. It's just not seen as a high priority in a lot of places.
But first, let's do the numbers. An early jump for the major indices and then a long, slow, steady decline to the bell. The Dow Industrial slipped 119 points, about 1%, closed at 11,493, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ gave back 33 points, 1.3%, finished at 2546. The S&P 500 fell 14 points, 1.2%, ended things at 1204. Financial shares led the sell-off. Goldman Sachs deflated 3.5% after that mortgage settlement we told you about. Investors worried other banks could also face fines. So Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, Morgan Stanley, and Citigroup fell more than 3% apiece. Oracle investors were hit with news that a federal judge has overturned a $1.3 billion settlement against tech rival SAP over some stolen software. Oracle shares dropped 0.8% today. Oddly, SAP shares fell 1.3%. I don't know. Go figure that one. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.13%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By CenturyLink, a new kind of broadband company linking Americans coast to coast with consistently fast speeds and personal service. More at CenturyLink.com. And by Ally Bank, offering IRA savings products and a Raise Your Rate 4-year CD. Learn more at allybank.com. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll also find our new podcasts, The Midday Update, Freakonomics, and The Tech Report, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports on unemployment for the month of August. On tomorrow's date, back in 1789, Congress created a permanent institution for the management of government finances, the Department of Treasury. Happy birthday, and happy birthday to Selma Hayek. She'll be 45. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Apple is, as most people know, a company that likes to let its products do the talking. Pretty much everything else, from Steve Jobs' health to who makes the innards of all those iPhones and iPads, is essentially off limits. And that brings us to today's story. A coalition of Chinese environmental groups is accusing Apple of ignoring some serious problems at the factories where all those gadgets are put together. But Marketplace's Steve Henn reports, thanks to the aforementioned secrecy, tracking Apple's environmental footprint is way easier said than done.
Researchers at the Institute of Public and Environmental Affairs in Beijing found evidence factories suspected of supplying Apple with parts are poisoning waterways. Other factories believed to be working with Apple have been cited by the Chinese government for environmental violations.
Apple's coming under the spotlight here because of their lack of disclosure.
Casey Harrells at Greenpeace. Harrell says environmentalists around the world want tech companies, Apple included, to be much more transparent about their supply chains, who they're working with, and what these factories are doing to the environment.
If you can't measure it, you can't improve upon it. And so we definitely push for sunshine.
Apple says it enforces, quote, a strong environmental code of conduct for all of its suppliers, audits them aggressively, and publishes what it finds. But when it comes to naming names of firms it works with in China, Apple prefers to keep its competition in the dark.
Well, Apple is extremely secretive. In fact, they're notorious for their secrecy.
Dale Ford is a supply chain analyst at IHS iSupply.
And so if you get an idea of who their suppliers are and who they're working with, you start to begin to speculate about what new features they're going to be implementing.
But if Apple doesn't disclose its suppliers or their environmental record to the public, Casey Harrell says Apple's consumers may never know exactly what their money is paying for. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
The United Nations said today it expects the already serious famine in East Africa is going to get worse over the next few months. The UN says almost 12.5 million people are in need of food assistance in Somalia, Ethiopia, Kenya, and Djibouti. Tens of thousands have already died, and refugee camps are overflowing there. Large-scale famines like that aren't new in East Africa or anywhere else. Thomas Keneally has a new book out about famine, three historic ones, specifically the Irish potato famine in the 1840s, the Bengal famine during World War II, and the one that most of us probably remember, the 1980s in Ethiopia. Mr. Keneally, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
For all the association with food that we have when we think of famine, this book really explains that it's not about food, is it?
Well, it's about food to the extent that if a drought occurs and a farmer and his family have one or two staples and you'd knock one of those staples out, they're in immediate trouble. But it's also ideology which causes the scale of the tragedy.
Well, I mean, how so? Explain that a little bit.
For example, if you believe that the famine is being over-exaggerated, as Churchill did with the Bengal famine in the 1940s, and if you fixed upon buying armaments, as the Ethiopian dictator Mengistu was, to wage war in the north of his country against the Eritreans, these count for more than the original catastrophe itself.
Why is it, though, that if so much of famine is made worse by people, why is it so hard for people to make famine better? Meaningful relief and aid is so, so difficult.
The nature of the distribution is going to be finally up to the government in place. If you have the sort of disorder you have in Somalia, if you don't have a fleet of trucks for the distribution of the food, if you don't have good roads, if there is an inadequacy of shelters, government shelters and clinics, these factors contribute hugely to famine also. Now, we're in a bit of a dilemma. We can be tough on the government, but then the people don't get fed.
Yeah, well, so dilemma's exactly it, right? I mean, should aid agencies look the other way so that the people get the food, or should they look harder and pressure the governments?
One does look, for example, at Ethiopia, and again, you've got not an act of God, but an act of specific men standing between the people and their food. if it had told the US or Europe or Australia, anywhere else, that at the height of the famine, Mengistu was buying Russian arms to pursue a totally unnecessary civil war, people wouldn't have been as generous, and it would have made it harder to raise the money. And to be honest, aid agencies are human too. They knew the Ethiopia was the biggest game in town. It's a profane way of looking at it. But there is an aid industry, and agencies compete for our dollars. And so to an extent, they couldn't afford to act up.
Thomas Keneally. His latest book is called Three Famines, Starvation and Politics. Mr. Keneally, thank you so much for your time.
Not at all. Thank you for the interview.
There's an excerpt of Three Famines on our website, marketplace.org/thebigbook. The fiscal problems of states and cities have kind of been lost in all the recent hullabaloo about federal debt and deficits. States and cities are still doing lousy, is the update. So an item in a report not too long ago from the U.S. Conference of Mayors caught our eye. It said almost a third of American cities have made provisions in their budgets for adapting to climate change. That is, potholes, police cars, and getting ready for global warming. Seeing as how climate change is still kind of a touchy subject, our sustainability reporter Sarah Gardner decided to dig into it and find out the real story.
Turns out it's not quite true. Lots of cities are investing in energy efficiency and cleaner power, but only about 30 are seriously thinking about investing in climate change adaptation. That means making plans for changes like rising sea levels, extreme drought, and more frequent storms. Stanford University researcher Suzanne Moser says, newsflash, American cities have barely begun.
In terms of actually making changes on the ground, there are very, very few that I can think of that are beginning to do that.
Among the few, Ventura on the California coast. It's moving all the facilities at famed Surfers Point 65 feet inland. Other cities are making plans for more drought-resistant trees and building bigger storm drains.
You know, because we have for so long debated just the fact of climate change, whether it's happening, whether it's human-caused, we're kind of behind the eight ball here.
Mike Henn doesn't want his city in that position. He's mayor of Newport Beach, California, where rising sea levels are already affecting some of the wealthiest people in the country.
Well, yeah, we had some very substantial storm events and heavy rain for most of the winter, and a couple of those storm events actually did cause flooding here on Balboa Island.
Henn stands near a 9-foot seawall in this close-knit neighborhood that some here compare to Mayberry. Well, maybe, if Sheriff Andy had a $1 million yacht. Henn and Councilman Ed Selich say they're convinced that rising sea levels will eventually threaten homes and businesses here. They're considering raising this public seawall several feet.
We have no option but to solve the problem. I mean, if you look at this real estate, this is the highest per square foot valued real estate in the United States, because these are small lots with very valuable homes on them. So not having a solution is not an option.
But in this conservative little city, there are plenty of climate change skeptics. Selich is among them. He says he doesn't know why sea levels are rising, just that they are. Newport needs to deal with it. That kind of attitude is why Jeannie Renee Malone doesn't even whisper the word climate change when she works with cities. Renee Malone is with the consulting firm HDR Engineering.
In some places, it's just easier to use words when we're talking about climate adaptation, such as risk preparedness, resilience, and other words. And what we always try to do is tie it back to economics.
But with cities strapped these days just to fill potholes and pay teachers, Renee Malone says climate adaptation gets short shrift at City Hall.
Climate adaptation is looking out 25, 50 years into the future. It's just not seen as a high priority in a lot of places.
Stanford's Suzanne Moser says there's little research on how much adaptation will cost in the long run. That's why Newport Mayor Mike Henn wants to get started now.
I feel a high sense of urgency about this. Just the planning alone is going to take time. And then because the improvements and changes that are necessary are so expensive, it's going to take a long time to actually implement.
Hen figures it'll take $50 million to start. That's the cost of raising those public seawalls on Balboa Island. In Newport Beach, California, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
On to something lighter now to bring things to a close. Actually, on to something heavier, but trying to get lighter. It's beer, a particular kind of beer to be precise, Guinness Stout. More people have probably heard of it than drink it in this country, anyway. One of our editors said today she thinks it tastes more like liquid tar than anything else. And really, therein lies the problem for the Irish brand owned by the beverage giant Diageo. Guinness is huge in Europe and in Africa. It's got, though, less than 2% of the American market. So Guinness is coming out with a new, dare I say it, lager. Sally Herships has more on this brewing apostasy.
Americans like beer. They drink $103 billion worth of it every year, most of it made in the U.S.
You know, kind of that yellow, fizzy, bubbly stuff that you see on the commercials.
John Craven is founder of BevNet.com. He says Americans like their brew cold and refreshing, a la Budweiser. Guinness is known for its thick, dark stout, which, according to the company, requires a pour time of 2 minutes. So enter Guinness Black, the brewer's new take on something lighter, a lager. Doug Campbell is in charge of the Guinness brand for Diageo.
Being the lager style that it is, it already will appeal more to kind of an American palate. So things that aren't quite as challenging going down.
Even if Guinness's new lager is easier to swallow, how do you get customers to buy it or even try it?
That, of course, is the crux of the marketing question.
So Campbell says Guinness will promote the beer with TV, digital, and print advertising, but it will also be doing blind taste tests.
Well, you can see the challenge that's facing Guinness because, you know, the brand is very distinctive, but it has a very unique product that has a, you know, fairly limited appeal.
Tim Calkins teaches marketing at Kellogg School of Management. He says Guinness is making a classic marketing move, stretching its brand. But he says it could be risky. If Guinness isn't careful, its new lighter beer could dilute the dark brand it's famous for. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by FreshBooks, an online invoicing service for freelancers and small businesses designed to help save time, look professional, and make invoicing easy. More at FreshBooks.com. And by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time. On the web at Putnam.com/large cap equity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, it being the first of the month, here's your Detroit versus the world update. Major car makers announced August sales today. Really, really nice for Detroit, actually. General Motors, Chrysler, Ford all had double-digit sales increases over August of 2010. Japanese auto companies, though, are still feeling the after effects of the earthquake earlier this year. Honda, Toyota, and Subaru all lost ground by a bit as well. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Thursday. Today, the Dow fell 119 points, 1%. The Nasdaq gave back 33 points, 1.3%. The S&P 500 slipped 14 points, 1.2%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time back here, boy, have we got a daily deal for you.
The largest sites have hundreds of salespeople.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM. That's American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.